That's a new version, or a new live version, should I say, of Highway Stars, this week's classic tracking. Previously unreleased, you can find it on the new single, or the current single, from Deep Purple, from the album Infinite, called All I Got Is You. That was recorded live in Aalborg. So it's our Deep Purple special, as they return with their 20th studio album release, Infinite, after 2013's Now What and 2005's Rapture of the Deep. However, it's prompted speculation that it could be their last album, with the title Infinite and the current tour being labelled as the Long Goodbye Tour, which starts next month in Europe, taking in North America and ends in the UK in November. The current Deep Purple lineup is, of course, Ian Gillan, Roger Glover, Ian Paice, Don Airey and guitarist Steve Morse, and the album was recorded in Nashville with producer Bob Ezrin. It's released on EM Music on CD and CD and DVD, 2LP and DVD, and has a small fan box, or a large fan box, and includes 10 tracks, including a cover of Roadhouse Blues, and it's set to become their highest charting album for 30 years, no less. In tonight's Deep Purple special, we'll bring you tracks from the new album, and we'll hear from Ian Gillan, Ian Paice, Don Airey, and firstly Roger Glover, talking about the making of the new album.
Came out of about three or four writing sessions. We have sort of jamming sessions where we have a bit of fun and play, and sometimes a bit of music appears, interests us, that might become a song. And it's actually, that's the fun part. It's all fun, actually.
The hard thing is, when you start the writing process, you have lots of ideas. And the first two or three days, you can bang, 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 bang. And they're all strong ideas, you know, because they've been building up. Then it gets a little more difficult, because then you're having to create new ideas, and sometimes you start accepting ideas just because you did them, not that they're particularly good. And that's the hard point, when you have to start becoming cruel to yourself, say, well, it's okay, but it's not as good as we did before. So that's the hard bit. But
in a way, whatever we do becomes us, becomes Deep Purple. There's no formula or sound that we're aiming for. We're just aiming to please ourselves musically.
It's all about human chemistry, really. I think when you get a bunch of guys together that have been together as long as us, there's no category other than Deep Purple for us. And it's like a bunch of guys that meet together in the pub or in the office or at home with relatives or whatever it might be. And you talk about this, you talk about that, and it's always a fresh conversation, even though the theme may be vaguely continuous or connected with the past. There's always a fresh element to it, and so, you know, that's what you do when you go to the pub, working with Bob. He said something very interesting when we were talking, before we even worked together. He said, I'd like to see you guys doing what you used to do, not in terms of the way you play your music, but the way you approach your music. And that is, if you find something good and you want to extemporize upon a theme, you do it. On the first three albums I was with the band and Roger, there were only seven tracks on each album, and some of them were quite long, 7 minutes, 8, 10 minutes long. And the reason was the music was a good vehicle to have extended pieces on. And the construction, the orchestral elements, or the soloists and the rhythmic drive were all developed until it reached a natural end, instead of being compressed into those three-minute things. I think during the Middle Ages, if you like, in the 80s and 90s, there was a tendency, as we produced ourselves, to kind of think of the radio element. Going back to Smoke on the Water, that was 7 minutes long on Machine Head. No one heard it apart from the live crowds, and it wasn't until somebody came along to a gig in LA and heard the audience reaction to it that they thought, this would be good, play on the radio. So they cut it down to 3 1/4 minutes. We were never any good at making pop songs. I mean, Deep Purple is primarily an instrumental band, and that's what we should do. And that's what Bob was saying with Now What. He said, let's just relax and extend your stuff. I'll tell you when it's getting too much, but just enjoy yourselves with the music. And so the old way of approaching construction came back, and everything got a little bit more exciting again, I think, because it was allowed to flow freely, and I think that showed instantly, which I love the other stuff as well, but this was definitely a major milestone as far as we were concerned. And so this Infinite record is a natural extension of that. It's not the same, but it's walking along the same path.
Since we did Perfect Strangers back in 84, it was no thrill from being in the studio. It's just one of the things you do. From making the Now What record in a great studio and everything working the way it should and everything being easy, recording became fun again. And that continued using the same situation on Infinite. It just felt right, it felt easy, it felt good. But in the past, we put ourselves in situations where it was almost impossible to make a record, you know, making life difficult for ourselves. So for me, it's been a revelation the last 4 or 5 years, just enjoying being in the studio and listening to the first one or two takes and going, wow, that sounds good, you know.
Being in Nashville as well was a tremendous spur to us all, because it's such a centre for music that is kind of missing now. You know, London used to be like that, but there's no music anywhere anymore, really.
No, New York's gone, LA's gone.
It's all gone, but Nashville is absolutely throbbing, so it kind of rubs off on you. And everybody in the studio was so enthusiastic, and they knew what they were doing. As Ian said, you know, they knew how to record a band. You know, in the old days with tape, you'd record something in a studio, terrified. The red light went on. And you play, and then you go in and they'd say, come in and listen. And when you listen back, you could hardly believe it was you. What have they done to it? You know, tape. It was so exciting, and we were getting that in Nashville. Well, it was great.
Now what, we started a kind of trend of opening an album with something unexpected. It worked well for that, and I think it works well for this too.
When we finished the track, I hadn't heard what they were going to put on top vocally. And so the whole beginning section, with a sort of Gregorian chanty type thing, was a complete surprise to me, you know. And how we get out of this, you know. I trusted them because there was always a way that they would find to get out of it, but it was, what's that? You know, interesting.
When you're trying to write a song over a finished backing track, you're trying to figure out what the music is trying to say, what kind of atmosphere you're trying to create, and how the words bounce and where it fits and everything. And the key to Time for Bedlam was really the organ part, the rhythm organ part.
I agree.
And so once we'd got that, it was actually relatively easy to figure out what the song was about. And Time for Bedlam was a working title. Working titles sometimes make finished titles, occasionally, not always, but Time for Bedlam was a kind of a nice phrase. We didn't know what to write with that title in mind until we just started rolling stuff, and I don't know where it comes from, really. Paul McCartney once saying, when asked where the songs come from, he said, well, it seems like they were always there, I just stumbled across them. And that's really how it feels.
Yeah, it was very live. We rehearsed long and hard in Nashville for 2 weeks with Bob, and a lot of the solos were live, so we had a lot of momentum. I think that's what comes across on the album. I mean, certainly listening to it the last 2 days, I remember I was in the room in the apartments in Nashville, and I was playing a rehearsal tape of one of the tracks, and there was a guy in mending the central heating. And he looked at me, listening. He said, man, that sounds just like Deep Purple.
When you're enjoying creating something new, you do find a different spirit in it. And if the guys in the studio are enjoying it, there's a good chance the listener will enjoy it too. If the guys in the studio are a bit bored, that comes through as well, you know. So I think it's about, any art is about connection, isn't it? If I talk to you artistically and you don't get what I'm saying, then there's no communication, no nothing. But if you understand what I'm saying, even if it's not words, then the communication has worked and the art is successful.
What do you mean by that?
I've no idea. And I stand by that.
I noticed.
Actually, I sit by it.
Said, I was an angry young man. Then I went through a period of complacency in my middle age, and now furious again. And without the F word, it doesn't make any sense. But I think, yeah, life goes like that, doesn't it? A bit up and down, and with a bit of that in the middle, you know. So I'm angry about lots of things. I'm not angry, I'm just involved and reactionary and pissed off. Politics mostly, that gets me excited. Yeah, and it's good to get worked up because you can get some venom into your work then. I like that. Just as we're writing lyrics, say things like, draining board, yeah, that's a good phrase, use that. Or hat, that's a good word, put that in somewhere. Time after time we'd hear this joke, and it always made us laugh. When you would say, well, look at it this way, you've got me, but all I've got is you. It's as if it's like a really bad deal. So we based the whole song upon that phrase as we're sitting around chatting, drinking tea and thinking about an idea for a song that came to us. And we wrote that down first and then we developed the song and it became a kind of thing. Anyway, this was something that we take out of our little moment of private humour. And it can develop into a whole song. It was a glorious piece of work. And at the end, of course, it's my modern interpretation of Gone with the Wind. Quite frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
On the new album, you've worked with Bob Ezrin again. Does he trust your instincts?
Well, he definitely trusts his.
Yes, he does.
And if he doesn't like something, he just tells you. You get, now stop, 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 and explain why what you thought was great wasn't so great. Because he has a great musical knowledge too, he can say it in a way that you understand where you went wrong. And he saves you wasting 4 or 5 hours going, you know, to a dead-end street. And that's part of his really great value in the control room. You don't waste time. You just get it done.
He'd spent quite a bit of time in London, and I used to do a lot of sessions. So when I was doing something with Bob, if he didn't like it, he'd talk to me in London studio speak with a London accent. Now, love, no, it ain't work. I think we'd better look for someone else. Who's that other keyboard player?
Canadian accent going.
The idea of going back in the studio with Bob was we couldn't wait, actually, to get back in the studio. It was that good an experience. And the thing about working with Bob is he insists on everything being as live as possible. So we're a live band, and we spend most of our time on the road, on stage. And in the studio is kind of a weird place to be creating music because it's a bit cold. But when we start playing together, all that disappears. And Bob's words to us on Now What was stretch out, two magic words. And I think since then we've taken his advice.
Told me to get out.
You came back again, though. When you're a kid, you start out doing this stuff because it's fun. Then it becomes your business and you have to treat it a little more seriously, but it should still be fun.
Yeah, you don't take it seriously.
And even, you know, these decades afterwards, you go on stage, it's still fun, you know. It can be chaotic fun, it can be disaster fun, it can be amazing fun. Even the bad bits when you look back, nobody makes you go on stage. You go on stage because you want to. It's fun.
It is a family, yeah.
Yeah. Dysfunctional, but...
as all families are, really, yeah. But it's a changing family. It's, how many people in the band now? 14 or something like that we've been through?
I think it's even more, it's deeper than that. I don't know. If you go back and watch video of, say, 40 years ago, are you that same guy? Do you recognise that guy?
No,
I don't. I don't recognise the young me. I can't remember what he was like.
I'd never wear those boots again.
And so that changes. You know, you know you were there, you did stuff. But occasionally I see little clips come up on YouTube and I have no recollection of me doing that. It's so long ago, and a small moment of your life suddenly is captured forever, and you see, I know it's me. I have no memory of doing these things at all. They're different people than what you are now, so you're frightening, really.
I just recently looked at a list of all the gigs we've ever done, and it goes on for days. I mean, page after page after page after page, and you realise that sudden moment that you're looking at your life. It's a very fortunate life. But it does require a great deal of sacrifice from family and your freedom. You lose your friends and stuff like that. But on the other hand, it's a kind of destiny. It feels like you didn't choose that life, it chose you. And you end up being where you are through a kind of series of minor miracles and scrapes and fights and bad times and good times. And somehow they all kind of roll into one. And here we are, that experience of going through those, even though you forget them. I looked at gigs, I can't remember playing there. But it's all part of what you become. And that experience goes into how we play and how we write.
There's a famous story, I don't know quite whether it's true, there's a band still going called Foghat, and they were playing in Vegas, and the bass player woke up in the morning, and there was a girl in bed with him who looked rather lovingly. "Who are you, my dear?" she said. "I'm your wife." And he'd been so out of it, he got married in the chapel after the gig at about 2 a.m, but had no memory of it. They're still married, 35 years on. You know, it worked out. But we played with Foghat a year ago, didn't we, in Concord in California. And I was dying to find out if it was true, but the guy wasn't in the band anymore. But the guys
His
in
wife
the band,
was.
They assured me it was. They assured me it was true. They said, yeah, it was true.
We're at an age now where maybe it's not the greatest thing to start writing about fast cars and young girls, or young cars and fast girls, or whatever it is. But we're always looking for stories. And that really, I think, if there is a theme, it wasn't a thought-out theme, but it's sort of, as you look at the album now, everything's a story. There's not one love song. In fact, One Night in Vegas is probably the closest thing to a love song on the album. It's all situations. You start off with a situation and write about it. It's actually a fun exercise to do that. It's a discipline, if you like, that we give ourselves, is to write an interesting story. And stories come from true life. They come from things that piss us off or whatever, things in the newspaper. They all come from our lives.
The hardest thing to do is to create a piece of music like Smoke on the Water. The simplicity is, it's difficult, man. That's the nonsense of it. Being complicated is quite easy. It's limitless, you can do what you want. Keeping something simple and to the point, that's...
Yeah, it's the hardest thing to do.
It's very, very hard to find. In rock and roll, sound's incredibly important. Rock and roll pushed the way we record things, to get clarity and power and everything that we accept now. And if you don't have that, when you play against other records, there's something missing. So the ability to capture that power and make people believe that they're getting the same impression they would if they're giving a live concert, if you don't have that, the record doesn't sound right. It's got to sound powerful, assuming you're talking about powerful music, you know. And again, Mr. Ezrin is very, very knowledgeable about how to do it, where to do it. When we were doing it, you go in, first take, two takes. There's no messing around for 2 or 3 hours trying to get a sound. You go in there, it's great, and then it gets better.
What makes a good song? Good song to me is something that surprises me. There's so much music out, and some great music too. Even now there's some great music. But once you've heard a verse and a chorus and you know what's coming next, it kind of loses its interest for me, which is why I don't listen to a lot of, you know, current pop or hard rock or anything like that. I listen to a lot of diverse, different kinds of music because I want to be stimulated by music, not just entertained.
I think Ray Charles said the best thing. He said, it's something that from the first 2 or 3 bars, you know it. He said, once you've said that, you don't have to say anything more because it's been said and everybody's involved and we're all part of the same thing. It's striking a chord with a common chord with people. I mean, that's what the Beatles did. Yeah. I don't really understand how they did it, but that's what they did. They connected with every single person. You couldn't unhear it.
It's a different world now, partly because it's a different world and partly because we're not of that age anymore. For us then, it was just life. And what happened to the bands of the 80s and the 90s is that they started imitating life. Life became a kind of a stereotypical choice of lifestyle, whereas us, it wasn't a choice, it was just it's what we did.
Yeah.
And I think you're right, that day to day, it wasn't all completely wild. As you look back decades, it becomes condensed into a wild time. And it's only looking back that you realise that it was a magic time. At the time, it didn't seem that magic. You just accepted it day by day. Oh, yeah, this guy called Hendrix, oh, great. You didn't think ahead as to what you would think looking back 20 or 30 years.
The great thing about that time was we had no machines, no technology, and we had a lot more time, didn't we, do fun stuff.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's part of it too. Well, that's the interesting thing now, finding which of these new songs will work in a stage environment.
I think probably of all the things that we have to do, I think that's the most challenging, is putting together and keeping fresh a good stage set. We never used to do what we thought people wanted us to do. We always did, like most bands, I think, of our kind, we did what pleased us and what made us feel good, and with keeping our fingers crossed that the audience would like it too. If you do something that your heart and soul is in, really think that you've got a good set and you're happy about it, then that transmits itself to the audience. Hopefully, it always has done, and I hope it will continue to go that way.
If you're a new band, it's really easy. You play your album. This is going to be the 20th album. Now, you cannot even take one song from each album. You couldn't do that in a night. You won't have enough time. So it's the toughest thing, as Ian said, we have to do. We've got to be very, very selective and very cruel sometimes. I mean, we don't compromise, but on some things we have to. Yeah. Say, well, you can't do that and that. You know, something has to go. And it's tough.
And there's also sort of magic ingredients where suddenly two songs just blend together. And then you get the flow and the dynamics. You've got to have texture, you've got to have dynamics in a show. You can't make it too demanding on an audience. You've just got to enjoy yourself and... Okay, you want to have a clap there, you can have a clap there, whatever, but, you know.
And it felt so far beyond the blue horizon, tempting me with transports of the light. When the devil took my hand and said, control.
is the story of a rock and roll band maybe gone wrong. Here's Ian Gillan.
Very poignant song, that. The rise and fall of a rock and roll band. But in the end, you know, it goes to show, actually, one of the things we've been lucky to avoid, and that is fashion. The idea of becoming successful with single records, and if you're fashionable, then by definition, tomorrow, you're unfashionable. So you really got to stick to what you are if you want to survive. I think that's an important lesson we've all learned. And it's all about music, basically. But this is about a sort of flash in the pan type of two or three hits and it's all over. But they've left behind something that we all love. And even though it may not have been cool to say 1 year after, then a few years after it's cool again. And there are some great songs that were absolutely of their time. And I think that's what this is about. And of course it's the archetypical story of people falling off, you know, half the band getting drunk, half the band getting off their heads, and you know, it's fairly normal really for five guys to do one or two to survive.
There's an interesting story behind the track Top of the World. Here's Ian Gillan.
It's a true story. It was in the Far East and I was doing a tour and I did a press conference, and after the press conference the guy from a well-known fizzy drink company that was sponsoring the show said, let's go to a club. So we went to a blues club. There was a band finishing. They were just about winding up. About 10 girls walked in. I mean, working girls. So we had a little dance and everything was great, had a couple of drinks, and then they did close, and the girl said, oh, we're having a party, would you like to come? Yeah, of course I would. And so I went along and went out of the commercial area into the banking area of the city, lots of glass high-rise buildings. We slipped down an alleyway and climbed up some steps at the back of a bank. We kept going until we got to the roof, and that's where they lived, these working girls. And there was a fire burning, and they were cooking rice, and they had wine. And we all got naked, because that was
natural.
And started dancing. It was magic. And I thought, I'm in heaven. Absolutely great. She was beautiful. We lay down. She fed me rice and wine. And I fell asleep. The next thing I remember, as it says in the song, was a sharp pain at sunrise, as the sun was coming up. And
oh, my mouth was open like that. Not like that, like that. And I opened one of my eyes, and a cockroach was going in and out of my mouth, taking it.
You couldn't make this stuff up, could you?
So I reached for the wine, drank this nectar that I'd... Oh, it's like vinegar, it's disgusting. And I looked across at Venus in Heaven, that's her name, and I thought, she was beautiful than the night before, but she was more... She was not, let's not say Rubenesque. She was...
Elephantine.
I mean, no, she was more Michelin than Rubin. Than, Michelin than Rubens. And it was... Oh, my God, I've got to get out of here. I couldn't find my clothes. Well, they were all over the place. I was wearing a suit and a tie and everything for this press conference, and I found everything except one shoe that had gone over the edge of the bank, and I found that on the way back to the hotel. But that was quite a night, and it was worth writing it down as a story, really. Yeah. But it's true.
The real challenge of that was getting all that story into a song.
Hot summer night, the working girls were on their way. Tagged along, couldn't let them walk alone. Followed them up some greasy steps to a rooftop in the sky. No walls around just to see a star. My throat was getting dry. Everyone could feel the heat. That's why we all disrobed. Dancing crazy, getting loose and closer to the edge. I could feel my blood was up and it was pounding in my head. So there I was, just me and the girls.
Beside the most beautiful girl in the universe, her name was Venus in Heaven. She fed me rice and offered me wine. I accepted ambrosia and nectar from an amber goddess. I collapsed between the thighs of Morpheus. Next thing I felt was a sharp pain at sunrise. My mouth was open and full of rice. As I managed to prise open one of my eyes, I saw Luigi the cockroach carry off his prize. And there lay Venus, still sprawled out and naked for sure, but not quite what she was the night before. I made my excuses and left through the door, stepped into space off the 20th floor, and that's why I don't like heights no more.
Well, Stephen Hawking said that before the Big Bang, there was nothing. Well, he's obviously wrong, because there obviously was something before the Big Bang, even though it wasn't in our understanding. It was a metaphysical whatever it might be. So therefore, infinity does exist in a series of bubbles or whatever, however you like to look at it. And if infinity does exist, then there was no beginning. And if there was no beginning, then we're not here. By definition.
It's all Stephen Hawking's fault, then.
Well, no, he just picked up, didn't he, where Euclid left off.
I mean, so I blame the Queen myself. She's infinite.
People can read a lot of what they like into the word infinite, especially this broken up into two cases of letters. Basically, it wasn't our idea. It's the record company's idea and a suggestion, and it was a good one, because left to our own devices, we'll argue till the cows come home about what's going to be the album title. It's always better to have an album title before you start, which we didn't have this time. And so when that came up, it was the decision of least resistance, I suppose. And you can read into it what you like. There's no decision been made about, is there going to be such a thing as a last gig? We're just going to carry on and see how it goes.
It's about 2 years away, I think. It's a two-year tour and an album, but I think it's about time. It's been put forward that we should call it a day. So therefore, we decided to have a band meeting, and we had too much wine, so we didn't really have a decision at the end of it. And so the goodbyes are going to be a bit longer than your average. It's like getting rid of unwanted guests, really, after Christmas.
It could be next week, don't want to do it, or it could be in 3 years' time, or whatever.
Or when any one of us just decides to...
Keel's over.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Well, that's the interesting thing now, finding which of these new songs will work in a stage environment.
I think probably of all the things that we have to do, I think that's the most challenging, is putting together and keeping fresh a good stage set. We never used to do what we thought people wanted us to do. We always did. Like most bands, I think, of our kind, we did what pleased us and what made us feel good, and with keeping our fingers crossed that the audience would like it too. If you do something that your heart and soul is in, really think that you've got a good set and you're happy about it, then that transmits itself to the audience. Hopefully, it always has done, and I hope it will continue to go that way.
If you're a new band, it's really easy. You play your album. This is going to be the 20th album. Now, you cannot even take one song from each album. You couldn't do that in a night. You won't have enough time. So it's the toughest thing, as Ian said, we have to do. We've got to be very, very selective and very cruel sometimes. I mean, we don't compromise, but on some things we have to. Say, we can't do that and that. You know, something has to go. And it's tough.
And there's also sort of magic ingredients where suddenly two songs just blend together. And then you get the flow and the dynamics. You've got to have texture, you've got to have dynamics in a show. You can't make it too demanding on an audience. You've just got to enjoy yourself. And OK, you want to have a clap there, you can have a clap there, and whatever, but, you know.
Keep your eyes on the road, your hands upon the wheel. Keep your eyes on the road, your hands upon the wheel. Hey, we're going to the roadhouse, we're going to have a real good time. We'll be right back.
hope you enjoyed our Deep Purple special, featuring tracks on the album, including Time for Bedlam, All I Got Is You, Birds of Prey, The Surprising, Johnny's Band, Top of the World, and their cover of Roadhouse Blues. And if you want to win a copy of the new album or some back catalogue, we've got three copies of Infinite to give away, and we've got some old Deep Purple albums to give away as well. In fact, one of them, Rapture of the Deep, is a special one that's signed by Don Airey. You know that Roadhouse Blues, the song, was done by The Doors in 1970. But a lot of other people have covered it. How many can you name? So it was done by The Doors originally in 1970. How many more bands can you name who have covered the song Roadhouse Blues? Rockshow at gtfm.co.uk if you want to win a copy of this album. Infinite from Deep Purple, our special feature on tonight's pre-Good Friday rock show. I think it's a great version of Roadhouse Blues as well. Some nice comments coming in on the email for the Deep Purple thing. Darren Keeler says, loving the Purple feature, great stuff, nice to hear some background about some of the songs. It is a really great album, I agree. Matt in Colford enjoyed it as well, thank you Matt. Coming up, classic tracking after the news at 11, something from Dream Theater. So get your answers in for that competition. Who else has done Roadhouse Blues as well as The Doors? Email address rockshow@gtfm.co.uk. This is The Rock Show on GTFM 107.9 in South Wales, BCFM 93.2 in Bristol, and of course on Rock Radio UK. We are repeated. If you missed any of the show tonight, we are repeated 11 p.m. on Saturday nights on Rock Radio UK. And also you can catch up on BCFM's Listen Again on their website. On 107.9.